After trudging back and forth through all the many curiosities on display at this year's Frieze London Art Fair, you'll understandably have worked up something of an appetite. Are the worlds of food and art really so different? Certainly not for some of today's leading print titles. Pull up a chair, pour yourself a glass, and join us for 30 minutes of print industry analysis here today on The Stack. Coming up today, never underestimate the power of a perfectly formed flourish of butter. David Lane from The Gourmand tells us more.
I think there's been a huge movement to kind of, we'll give you the food whenever we want, sit on a bench, sit in a car park, pay just as much. There's something lovely about going out and being really well looked after, and this is a bit of a homage.
Also ahead, as newspapers around the globe look at ways to downsize, we'll talk to one publication doing quite the opposite.
The Berliner format, despite its tremendous advantages, has significant constraints when it comes to design and when it comes to space.
And a little later, we visit another editorial flaw, that of Drum, a South African magazine that stared down its share of unfriendliness and is still turning pages. That's all today on The Stack on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Stack, coming to you from Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. A rich tapestry of topics ahead of us today. Let's start with something close to all our hearts, food, and food on the printed page. David Lane is the editor-in-chief, I think I'm right in saying, of The Gourmand, and he joins me in the studio. Hello.
Hello.
Nice to see you again. And we have, virtually still hot, piping hot off the presses, the latest Gourmand, food and culture journal to the uninitiated. Most of our listeners are connoisseurs, I would say. Happy with the latest iteration?
Very happy. Yeah, really good. Lots of great people have been involved this time. So it's really lovely to see it in the flesh. I'd say it's warm, not hot.
Yeah, warmish, I'd say. Now, we've talked often about this, you know, there's a lustrous illustration, there's an excellent, playful... Well, several excellent playful photo shoots and a very nice, I don't know, this is slightly kind of austere maybe by the Gourmand standard about the dinings and the detail and looking at sort of, well, the details that make it in certain London restaurant institutions, which I particularly enjoyed.
Yeah, we really like that. I think there's been a huge movement to kind of, we'll give you the food whenever we want, sit on a bench, sit in a car park, pay just as much. Sorry, it arrived after your dessert, but... You have to pay for the burger anyway, you know.
And that's not right all the time, is it?
I think there's something lovely about going out and being really well looked after. And this is a bit of a homage to these kind of old school institutes. Some of them actually not old school, but kind of channeling the old school in their approach. And things like your lemon being wrapped in muslin so you don't get the seeds on your fish, which is unnecessary, but lovely.
It's a nice touch. And just generally tell me, so you talk about, you know, the parade of talents involved. I mean, still, presumably, is that a delight for you every time you're putting an issue together
with
your brilliant team to be able to kind of call on, you know, friends, people you admire? It must be a lovely way of working.
It is a really nice way of working. And our core team of people, our editor, our sub and managing editor, photo editor, all those people are so fantastic. And then also all the collaborators. And unlike some other magazines and like some magazines, we all have other practices and roles elsewhere, which I think kind of makes it richer. So we bring in lots of different people from our different worlds.
Well, it's interesting. That actually leads me rather neatly, David, to ask you about the many other hats that you wear. And you've got some exciting projects that you're tackling in the months ahead. A bit of a sort of exclusive for us here on The Stack. And we're going to talk actually later in the programme about some art titles that you've brought with you, which is a clue, perhaps, as to where this chat is going. We've obviously been live on Monocle 24 at Frieze this week, at the Arts Fair, of course, in Regent's Park, just a stone's throw from where we are. And... I gather that will be something you're turning your sights onto next.
Yeah, so Frieze pre-Art Fair was, of course, a publication. It still is a very good publication, and I'm going to be working with them as the new art director there. The current art director, who did an incredible job and the design's still brilliant, has moved on to other things, so I'm going to be doing a redesign and a relaunch visually. And there may be some kind of editorial changes alongside that come into play too. in the beginning half of next year of certainly a Frieze magazine, potentially a Frieze Masters, and some other projects around that.
Well, we'll delve into it in more detail a bit later in the programme. David Lenn's going to stick around, and we're going to talk more about his art titles that he's brought in this Frieze week later in the show. But we've got trips to, well, all around India, South Africa. Our worldwide tour on the stack continues after this. India's newspaper market is huge. More than 82,000 newspapers are currently being published around the country. It's hard then to think there's any room for growth, but the industry is nevertheless expanding and evolving. Most of this is in regional language publishing, but the small segment of English language papers is also growing. One relatively new entrant is the Business Daily Mint, which launched back in 2007. Designed by Mario Garcia and with the Wall Street Journal as a content partner, its credentials were certainly sound. Back then, it was in the Berliner format, but it's recently relaunched as a broadsheet, an indication of just how healthy things are looking. Monocle's New Delhi correspondent, Arti Bettegheri, caught up with Mint's editor, Sukumar Ranganathan, to find out more about the redesign.
We started Mint in 2007. We actually started thinking about it in 2006. Back then, there were around four Indian business newspapers. A fifth was in the works, so we were going to be either fifth or sixth. And a lot of people were wondering whether the country needed a fifth or sixth business daily. The reason why we decided to launch Mint was because we felt that there was a gap in the market for an authoritative, analytical business daily, which gave people not just the news, but a perspective of the news, a context of the news, in a very international design and a fairly global approach to journalism. And it seems to have clicked with the readers. We've done exceedingly well in the span of 9 years. We'll be 10 next year. In the span of 9 years, we won more international awards than many of the other newsrooms put together.
So just describe for me the landscape of the print newspaper industry in India. I mean, it's quite vibrant. You've got the largest selling newspaper, Dainik Jagran, which of course is in Hindi, which ships something like 20 million copies a day. Then even regional language newspapers, say in Kerala, moving more than a million copies a day. I mean, these are figures that would be, you know, just a far off dream for a newspaper publisher in the West. Where does Mint fit into this?
That's an interesting question also because we share the newsroom with two other mastheads, which are owned by the same company, HT Media Limited. One is Hindustan Times, which is India's second largest English language newspaper. And one is Hindustan, which is India's second largest Hindi language newspaper. And the readership of both these newspapers is in the millions. They are huge enterprises and huge newsrooms, and in the middle of all this you have Mint. I think today the Mint brand of news and analysis and views probably stands for something that is honest, very credible, very trustworthy, deeply insightful, perspective laden, with lots of numbers, right? We are not averse to frightening readers with high-end mathematical techniques if they are required to analyze data, except we'll try and explain it in a way that a 10-year-old could understand.
Now, last week when my copy of Mint slid under my front door, I got a huge shock. I'm used to the Berliner size of the newspaper, but suddenly it had grown in size. It had become a broadsheet. Now, I understand this is quite a significant relaunch for you guys, and it's one that is really significant, I think, not just in India, but globally, where a lot of newspapers are finding that declining readerships mean they've got to completely change their strategy, either move to a digital-first strategy or consider stop printing Monday to Fridays, just being online and having a bigger, more substantial magazine-style format on weekends, or various other strategies. What led you to take this step?
For us, the most important reason was the fact that the news market in India has changed. When we launched, in 2007, digital was a very nascent medium in India, and people still wanted to read several newspapers. Most people would read 2 newspapers or 3 newspapers, and when I say most people, I speak of most people who are typical Mint readers or business newspaper readers, people of a certain economic background, people who work in certain kind of companies, people who are interested in business and economic news. And over a period of time, with the spread of the digital medium, we noticed, and this is backed by research, that a lot of readers are reading just one newspaper, right? So they want to get everything they can get from one newspaper. Now, the Berliner format, despite its tremendous advantages, has significant constraints when it comes to design and when it comes to space. When we started, we said we would do less, but we would do more of less, which means we would drill deep into subjects and give people what they wanted, which is very different from the approach of several other newspapers, which do less of more, right? I mean, you cover a huge breadth of subjects, but you cover them all in a fairly shallow, superficial manner. Now, I think, given the reading habits of people, what you really need is more of more, right? I mean, you need to cover a lot of issues, and you need to cover a lot of them in detail. And we just felt that a broadsheet would probably suit the content requirements a lot better. But at the same time, we're also doing a lot of other things. And the third reason why we wanted to change, of course, is because the world has changed, right? I mean, we are now talking of colonizing Mars. Artificial reality and virtual reality are real, right? I mean, they're no longer in the realm of science fiction, which are working in these areas. And you again have an entire new economy that's opening up. So that is another emerging content focus for Mint.
Thank you very much, Artie. This is The Stack on Monocle 24. The beat goes on. That's the tagline for South African magazine Drum, the preeminent black lifestyle magazine in Africa. Started in 1951, it avoided the tight press controls and political clampdowns of the apartheid regime to become renowned for giving voice to the oppressed. It also offered a training ground, otherwise largely unavailable to many black journalists and photographers. But over 60 years since its inception, and facing accusations of having lost the radical edge which made its name, what is Drum's future in a post-apartheid and a post-print digital world? Our reporter Gavin Fisher strolled the magazine's editorial floor in Johannesburg to find out.
So I'm actually in the centre of the office, and then I sit there so that I can see what is happening.
Check if they're doing their work.
Not yes, I mean, look, a lot of people are actually...
Drum editor Tandium Tetwa strikes you as a woman with full control over her domain and a hand in everything it produces. Her office vantage point may give a good view of Drum's staff, but you sense her focus lies further afield.
We are actually aiming to your black South African men and women, your black middle class. They are very aspirational, very ambitious, they are upward mobile. And so Drum is able to give them that information, Drum is able to inspire them, and Drum is able to be the voice of reason for them, is the voice of the voiceless for them.
How has their what they want to read and what they want to consume changed since the end of apartheid?
For the longest time during apartheid, influencers, I would call them influencers or public figures, they were not really, because of the dynamics of what was happening in the country, so they were not exposed to the media. And so they really did not have any influencers. So then the public figures started rising up, they started driving cars, they started, you know, owning businesses, all of that. So those people started influencing our readers.
These celebrities have led to a new group of black celebrities whose stories are a big part of Drum's content.
My name is Kama Daile, and I'm a content provider for Drum magazine online. This is basically something really fun. It's a new show that's been launched in South Africa. It's called Lip Sync Battle Africa.
So how central is this kind of content to the website as a mix?
Basically very important to be able to strike a balance. People want to know what's going on in the country, but also they want to get home and relax after a long day of work, can read things that mean nothing to them, really. So celebrity stories are fun. They also do teach a lot of people about themselves as well. So it's very important to be able to strike a balance between news and celebrities.
Flicking through magazines in the archives of Drum in downtown Johannesburg, seeing the pictures of life during apartheid, it feels a long way from this modern celebrity and showbiz. I visited with former Drum photographer Mike Mizzoleni.
When Drum started in the early 50s, black people didn't have a voice. So Drum was the first publication that, especially in those days, it was about the politics of the ANC. But then it was not just politics. Like in any newspaper or a magazine, it should balance. It shouldn't be just about politics.
If Mike's work was very varied, he would become best known for his pictures from the 1976 Soweto uprisings, where hundreds of school pupils were killed by police while marching against the apartheid education system.
For you to be a good photographer, one, you must be brave. And when you are assigned, you have to deliver. You have to get your picture at all costs, even if at times could cost you your life. But we never think of our lives. We were just, the mind was on getting a picture. There were times when I went on assignments, and when I get to the dark room, I see the pictures, I start getting scared. But did I really risk my life for this? But at the time when I was taking those pictures, I didn't see danger. My mind was in just to get the picture and nothing else.
It may have represented black South Africans, but Drum was in fact started by a white man from England, Jim Bailey, who was a World War II fighter pilot, a writer and a publisher. He died in 2000, but I gave a call to his son Beezy Bailey. Now a renowned artist, he too spent time working at Drum.
So this was in the early 80s, and I went there immediately after leaving school. And I'd done the two-year compulsory military service. So I came straight out of the Air Force into Drum magazine, which was a very different world, as you can imagine, and quite always historically was a kind of bubble of an anti-apartheid world in an apartheid country. And there were, you know, the kind of ramshackle floor of the you know, the journalists with paper all over and the terrible mess everywhere. And the photography, there was kind of the whole thing. I think ramshackle is a good description, but, you know, amazing characters around the place.
With your experience of Drum, what do you make of the magazine now?
Drum now has become something of a kind of nothing what it used to be. It's, you know, I suppose it's more of a money thing. And you know, it was very strongly illustrated by the same Barney Cohen, who was the editor and I was working there and remained the editor after it was sold. And I said, you know, what's it like, Barney? And he said, we've got the offices in Sandton and the Mercedes-Benzes and we've lost our soul.
So would Jim have judged the modern day incarnation of Drum harshly, do you think?
I think so, yes. You know, not necessarily harshly, but with certain sadness. I think in Jim's particular case, because it was such a personal thing, and again, he described it as being his mistress, the loss of that mistress was huge.
Drum is now owned by one of the largest media organisations in South Africa. But as the editorial team plan the next edition, Tandi Mtetwa says any suggestion that the heart has been taken out of the magazine is unfair.
We are now in a position where, as Drama Kazini, we are storytellers. And we've always been doing storytelling, even in the 50s, when Jim Bailey founded this magazine. It was all about telling the stories of black South Africans. And for as long as, you know, there are South Africans that wants to read stories about their own lives and wanting to be told in their own language, when I'm saying language, I'm saying in their own way of telling their stories, we will continue to do that. The future is very bright for us.
And do you think that black people will always need their own magazine?
Black people will always, look, I'll be very honest with you, only black titles can be able to speak to the hearts and the needs of a black reader. Because only us, only black brands can tell the stories, you know, in a way that is South African, in a way that is local as lekker, in a way that, you know, that uses the Mzansi lingo. It's only us that are able to do that.
That was Gavin Fisher reporting from Johannesburg and the editorial offices of Drum magazine. The This is The Stack on Monocle 24. We couldn't end the show without perusing some of the titles that David Lane has brought with him. David, we were talking about Gaumont. We were talking about your work with Frieze, of course, in Frieze Week, appropriately enough. So presumably you've been seeking, I don't know, additional inspiration, or maybe you've been returning some old favourites in the sort of art magazine space. Maybe start with the top of the pile there and tell us how that fits in.
This is Spike magazine, which is German art magazine. Very good art director in Berlin who also does Zeit magazine and a few other art titles does it visually. And there's a good editorial team. I actually just picked up, there's a fantastic reading room at Frieze with all sorts of different titles represented. And I picked up a few that I've always liked that I thought potentially might not be the most obvious go-to ones for all sorts of different reasons. Have a peek.
Let's have a browse. And it's interesting, as you say, when you get there's certain kind of stables, there's people whose approach, whose views you kind of trust. Are there particular art directors whose work you always track, or does it happen the other way around?
Yeah, there are, definitely. I think it's a really interesting one within art magazines. There seems to be two approaches, one of which is to take the fact that you can kind of have fun with it and run with that and go pretty far out. And that's what he's very good at doing. It's tricky because you're presenting lots of work by other people and you don't want to maybe apply too much of your own ideas and style on top of that, because ultimately it's not really the content. And there seems to be another approach which is incredibly conservative to the point that it's sort of nothing. So this next one that I brought, Camera Austria, which is a fantastic photography magazine, visually is sort of stripped back to it's that. I mean,
yeah,
that, because you're listening and not looking, is a photograph on one page.
And then two columns of quite small
text
copy
in
on
Times
another, yeah.
That looks, you know. And I think, I don't know, what we're going to try and do with Frieze is somewhere in the middle, I think, which we shall see how that goes. But
are you charting, I don't know, it's interesting, are you charting a bit of a return, well, not return, but elements of this idea about clarity, stripping things down a bit? You know, is there a sense in certain quarters that maybe, you know, we've looked at every experimental angle and there's something, I don't know if it's reassuring, there's certainly something quite clean about, you know, a more austere, a more, what would you call it, maybe traditional.
I mean, when you go to an art gallery, there's nothing there between you and the work. Mm. They're designed to remove every obstacle and every additional piece of information. So you're in a white cube, essentially. With a lot of artists' books, the same's true, bar maybe the cover. With arts magazines, it's not true. And I think there's potentially the like exciting reaction now could actually be to do something a bit more traditional.
Again, to capture the moment, David has what I can only describe as a playful look on his face. But this is exciting. We'll sort of watch how these things filter through into the new project. So tell me about. I mean, this one is, as you say, it is pretty extraordinary. It's got some kind of almost there is a cataloguey quality to it as well, which again is presumably quite deliberate.
I love it. This is actually an older one, and I used to subscribe to it. So this isn't one I picked up at Frieze. It's fantastic. I think you can read the essays. They're well written. They're interesting. I mean, sometimes they're a little bit too dense. And certainly we were talking about the design. That doesn't help. You know, you're confronted with thousands of words in one go.
And it is in German and English as well. So that adds a little extra.
Exactly.
There's an extra density on the page as well.
Yeah. But the photography is printed very well. Mm. It is like a catalogue. It's like walking through an exhibition.
And I guess that's the point in a way, right?
It is, and it's really interesting. It's a sort of survey of what's happening now, and that they have interesting themes. I think it works really well.
Excellent. So that was number two. What else have you got? Let's continue down
so
to the bottom
third
of your stack.
So the third one is another photography magazine, which takes a completely different approach, which I'd say is more traditional in its editorial, in that there's a front section and then there's essays and then there's pictures at the back, which is kind of how you'd imagine magazines.
And this is quite it's got a bit of heft to it as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's Aperture, and again, it's a fantastic magazine. The print quality and the materials is incredibly high, and I was looking in the colophon, it's printed in Turkey, which is interesting because I know lots of publications that are printed in Italy or Eastern Europe. It's really impressive, which is good for a photography magazine because
You've obviously got to always remember who your reader, who your subscriber, the buyer of your magazine is. Are there people then who are going to, I guess, hold you to a higher standard almost if you're trying to write authoritatively about photography or about the arts? I guess people are justified in saying, well, look, you need to set the bar pretty high if you're going to speak with an authoritative voice.
Yeah, I guess so. I think there's different publications have different takes on it. It's harder and more intelligent to present things simply and without lots and lots of fluff. And I think that's one thing Frieze does really well. Mm. It presents complex ideas in a way that is actually quite approachable.
And do you think that the driver of that is the confidence, the authority then of the editorial team and the art director and how they all work together? Is that the thing that matters?
I think
there?
So. I mean, it's an incredibly hard topic to cover because it's in its essence, it's about the now. And you can't just sit in an office and write about it. You have to go to every opening and understand what's happening and what the sort of very coal face of the whole art world is. If it was a magazine about the history of art, you probably could sit in an office. But so I think it's really hard. And I guess because they're an established organisation and because everybody involved has been there for a while, they've got the balance right and they do that really well.
It's an exciting time, David, no doubt. So remind us then about when we'll see the fruits of your redesigning labour. Sometime in the new year?
Yeah, it'll probably be... There's a really interesting publishing schedule. It's 8 times a year, which runs alongside a schedule of fairs and things. So I would say it's probably for the March issue.
Okay.
The next issue of the Gourmand will be out around the same time as well.
So it won't be that busy for you at the start of 2017 then?
It'll be fine. Yeah, it's really good. They're both going to fit together really well. There'll be lots of time to do all sorts of things.
I'm going to have loads of time, all right? I'm going to keep saying that to myself. David, it sounds very, very exciting. Always a pleasure, a delight to have you with us on the Stack. An excellent stack of magazines, as always. And I trust we'll speak again before the busy time at the start of 2017. But if not, you must come and show us the fruits of your
I'd love to. And we're going to be doing lots more fun Gourmand events between now and then. There's been murmurings that are... Dog Show will return also.
Well, a number of fans in and around this building, if that were to happen. So keep us posted.
If there's a fashion correspondent, they can have a front row seat.
Perfect. Perfect. David Lane, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks very much for coming to see us on the Stack.
Thank you.
That is all we have time for on today's programme. Special thanks to David Lane for coming to see us and to our producers, Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editor, Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome as always, info@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. You can catch up on this episode and delve into the archive at monocle.com via iTunes or on your preferred podcast platform. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for tuning in.